Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Game one, NBA Finals. Tonight, finally here, Golden State at Toronto. You could not ask for more or better storylines. You've got the team that's in the final for a fifth straight time against the team that has never been there before. Oakland's last finals. Jurassic Park's first. Steph, Clay, Draymond versus Kawhi, Kyle, Pascal. Steve Kerr going back to the finals again. Nick Nurse getting there in his first year. And as always, the all-important argument, rest versus rust. Hell yeah, the greatest pre-series debate ever is back. Who has the advantage? How much rest is too much rest? When does rest turn to rust? Does the fact that Golden State's been waiting for more than a week mean that they're well-rested, or does it mean they're too rusted? In the case of Kevin Durant, it means that he was spotted yesterday walking around without a noticeable limp, but he's not playing game one. Game two feels like that would be a stretch. So if it's not this weekend, when does the guy come back? And if you're Golden State, should you even consider playing him before you lose that first game? They haven't lost since he went down. So would you play him before you lose, even if he is ready to go? Again, they've won five in a row without him. And if you're still winning, do you really want to disrupt that? Even if it is Kevin Durant, even if he is a free agent to be. And then what does all that mean to all the matchups and for the pace of the game? And what if Golden State does lose a game? What if Golden State loses two games? In fact, can Golden State win four games without Kevin Durant? And when Durant's not there, does Nurse put Kawhi on somebody like Andre Iguodala so he can sag off the way Draymond did against the Blazers forwards? And speaking of Draymond, where do you put him? Speaking of injuries, how much can the Warriors expect from DeMarcus Cousins? And when do they use him? And what about the second units on both teams? Can Fred VanVleet keep on killing it the way he did in the final three games against Milwaukee? How about Danny Green? Can he find his shot? And after killing his interview on this show yesterday, does Kevon Looney have a triple-double tonight? Or is it a quad-double? And then obviously the other big question is Drake. Because even if this series is not about him, you know he'll make it about him. Or at least he'll think it's about him. Because if it was a big deal in the conference finals, there is no way you're sitting this guy down in the NBA finals. Not when the games are on broadcast TV, not when the audience is bigger than ever, and not when he has a chance to get even more people to look at him and talk about him. Because isn't that what that's all about? Nobody acts the way that guy acts unless they want people looking at him and reacting to them. But then again, the league did talk to him about that act. According to reports, the NBA spoke to the Raptors about Drake's antics during the conference finals. Adam Silver went a step further with Chris Haynes on his podcast. The commissioner said this.
That I think Drake understands that, you know, as excited as he is and as appreciative we are of his support, that there's got to be lines drawn. And obviously you don't want to end up touching a coach because the coach may not realize what's going on in the middle of the action. And I think, you know, there's a line, too, in terms of sitting right on the floor in terms of engagement, whether it's with the referees and players on other teams. I mean, it's hard to calibrate sometimes exactly where that line is. Mm-hmm. And I think he has a better understanding now of where that line is.
It's actually not that hard at all. What do you mean it's hard to calibrate where that line is? He's got a better understanding where that line is. We all know where the line is. The line is you cannot be hitting your coach with baby oil and rubbing him up on the bench during the game. That's where the line is. What you and your coach do in your off time together is your time and none of our business. And I don't care. Just don't be doing that during the game, and especially in the NBA Finals. So, from Durant to Drake, there are a ton of questions about the series. There's so many unknowns, but here's one thing that I do know. You best not take any of this for granted. Do not take Golden State being here for a fifth straight time for granted. Do not assume that because they are there for a fifth straight time that it's old hat and that it's gotten boring and they no longer have a chip on their shoulder. Trust me, they do. Also, do not assume that they're just going to run over Toronto because they're Golden State, with or without KD. don't assume the win. Don't assume that fourth ring just because they're Golden State, because Toronto is no joke. In fact, they're a threat. They're a legitimate threat. They've got the home court. They're fierce defensively. They have arguably the best two-way player in the game right now in Kawhi Leonard, who is a near impossible matchup and at the peak of his powers. And they're more than just Kawhi. And just because you don't know the names of some of their guys, or just because you thought that Kyle Lowry wasn't clutch or that Marc Gasol was washed up, doesn't mean that's true. Man, they aren't just good. They're damn good. And they just beat the team with the best record in the NBA four straight times. So this is not just Kawhi and scrubs or Kawhi and company. They are a full team, one that is extremely well coached, one that can cause a ton of problems, even for arguably the best team ever. One more thought about Golden State, too. Winning an NBA title is hard. Winning 3 and 4 years is incredibly hard. Winning 4 and 5 is crazy. Every single trip to the finals is grueling and tiring. It's a grind. It takes so much out of you. Eventually, it's going to catch up to you. It catches up to everybody. Every single run ends at some point, and often when you least expect it. Just don't try running that up on Draymond Green, because this guy plays the game for these very moments, and Draymond is fired up. Here he was yesterday, just walking down a hallway, talking about the Raptors fans.
Day before game one, how does it feel?
Oh, it feels amazing. We starting on the road. Fans outside booing when we walk out the hotel. This is good right here.
He loves that stuff. It only got better. Here's Draymond at the podium, dropping knowledge, talking about basketball and the finals, but really talking about life.
As a competitor, if you're trying to do something meaningful, if you don't have the mindset that you're the best ever, you failed already. So if you don't have the mindset that you are the best reporter ever, then you already failed. And that's been my mindset since I can remember. That will be my mindset as long as I can remember anything, that I am the best ever at what I do. And every day that I step on a basketball floor, I will strive to be that. But my mindset will always be as such as I am the best to do what I do. And that'll give me a shot at being the best. But before you can ever reach anything, you have to believe it. You don't just mistakenly become great at something. You probably at one time or another believe that you can be great at that. And then you work to get great at that, and you reach that greatness. But you don't mistakenly become great. And then you start to believe, oh, man, I'm great at that. No, you believed that before, and you work to get that. So I always believe that, and I'll work every day to reach that.
This guy might as well have been talking to every last one of the smack-off contenders. 81 seconds of gold right there. If that does not get you fired up for tonight, for the rest of the week, for the rest of your life, man, that's on you. Game one, tonight, finally, let's do this. Who you got? And you know he's a jungle legend. Ben Golliver is my guest. It's always good to have you. Ben, how are you?
I'm great, Jim. I'm here in Toronto, and there was kind of a pinch yourself moment yesterday, the NBA Finals Media Day. Kyle Lowry's up there on the podium taking questions, and all of a sudden the Warriors just kind of walk in. You know, that parade of talent comes in, Kevin Durant, DeMarcus Cousins, Steph Curry, Draymond Green, Klay Thompson, and Lowry just stops himself mid-sentence and kind of watches them and takes a look. And then once they finally walk by, you know, he resumed his answer. Now, you can prepare your whole career for this moment, right? You can be in the game plan sessions, the film room, getting ready for the, you know, the defending champs and trying to take them down in the NBA Finals. But once you actually see them in that building, it's a little bit different. There's really no preparation for it, and I think that's where we are right now with this series.
What a great scene setter right there. Are you doing a repair that needs a special tool? O'Reilly Auto Parts makes it easy with our loaner tool program. Over 80 specialized loaner tools are available. We're sure to have a tool in stock to help you get that job done right. Purchase the needed parts, put down a deposit on that loaner tool, and then return the tool in its original condition and receive a full refund. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. Ben Golliver joining us on the program. All right, so Ben, let me ask you this. In terms of the matchup itself, I'll get to that. But first, who are the Toronto Termites and how they get that nickname?
Oh, man. You know, these Raptors fans are nuts, Jim. They love their team. They're so locked in. They're so devoted, you know, sometimes to the point of delusion. So a few years ago after these playoff failures, I nicknamed them the Termites, just saying, look, there's nothing you can do to get rid of them. They're always going to come back. It doesn't matter if there's a Chernobyl, nuclear holocaust, whatever. They're still going to be there supporting their team. And when you look around this city, it's pretty amazing. I mean, everybody knows, you know, Canada and hockey are synonymous. They've got people outside the building at the arena at 7 a.m., you know, standing up in line so they can watch the game outside. They don't even have tickets. They're not going to the game. They're just going to watch it on the screen with a bunch of, you know, their friends. It's probably tens of thousands of people out in what they call Jurassic Park, the outdoor viewing area. They're having viewing parties across the country in various cities, you know, and suburbs outside Toronto as well. So it's not just Drake. You know, Drake gets all the credit for being the ambassador for the team. He's the guy who's, you know, rubbing the coach's shoulders during the game and, you know, talking trash to all the opponents and all of that. But I think Drake actually kind of stands for, like, you know, the hundreds of thousands of people who have caught the basketball wave here and who are pretty excited about, you know, what Kawhi Leonard's been able to do for these Raptors and how they've finally been able to get over the hump and make the first finals in their franchise history.
Ben Golliver joining us. All right, so on the topic of Kawhi Leonard, you made the point that he is the most interesting person in the NBA Finals. For instance, how different is his role in this year's Finals versus the role he had back against the Heat in 2014?
Oh, it's role reversal, isn't it? I mean, in 2014, he's like the 3-and-D specialist who his job is just to chase LeBron James around, and whatever LeBron does, you know, he's going to be shadowing him, and that's going to be kind of his focus. Anything he does offensively is kind of a bonus for that team. He wasn't the headliner. Obviously, the headliner was Tim Duncan, and then Manu Ginobili, and then Tony Parker, and then we get down to Kawhi Leonard, and he had a very key role in that series. There's a reason why he won Finals MVP, but the emphasis was on the role. I think here in 2019, he's basically the LeBron figure for these Toronto Raptors. He's doing everything. Offensively, he's been their main weapon all postseason. He stepped up his scoring. He's been super efficient shooting the ball from three-point land, from the mid-range, getting to the free-throw line, you know, basically doing it all. He set a career high in assists during this postseason with 9, having to do a little bit of playmaking because, you know, he's facing double teams and things like that. Again, much like the role LeBron has had here in the postseasons in years past. And then defensively, he's been on another level too. I mean, he was so central in locking up Giannis for Milwaukee in that Eastern Conference Finals, totally changed that series. And he's going to have his hands full in this series too, because I think he's the type of guy where he's going to see minutes on, you know, Draymond and Clay and probably Steph and Kevin Durant if he comes back healthy. I mean, he's going to have to be all over the court leading their defensive attack. So to me, that two-way presence is what makes him sort of the deciding factor of this series, right? If Toronto's going to pull the upset, it's because Kawhi was the best player on the court, period, and he outplayed Steph and he willed this team to victory. If Toronto goes down, I think like a lot of people expect, like the odds makers expect, it's because he was not quite able to overcome the entire Warriors attack, much like we've seen from LeBron here in the last couple of finals where they just get overwhelmed. So to me, those are the stakes of this series, and we'll see how it plays out.
Ben Golliver joining us. Of course, Ben, he's not going to talk about this. Neither will the Raptors. But what do you think this great run that they made in the postseason and how well he's played for them during the run is impacting his thinking about going forward in free agency?
Well, I think Toronto is actually in a really good place about it. Masai Ujiri, their president, who's very popular around the league, he gave a little press conference yesterday, and he basically kind of put his cards on the table and made it sound like, look, we've kind of done everything we could. And he pointed to that game winner that Kawhi Leonard hit at the end of Game 7 against the Sixers. You know, it bounces in, and they advance to the finals, and Kawhi is surrounded by his teammates. He's so excited. He's shouting and showing all this emotion that we rarely see from him as sort of kind of a turning point moment for them. It's like, look, if that doesn't convince him what we're about as an organization, as a team, and as a fan base, you know, maybe nothing will. They've already put up murals of that shot around the arena. So if you're walking around the building, there's pictures of his celebration and then a picture of the shot itself. So they're pulling out all the stops, and they've made their best case possible. And I think, you know, it's going to wind up in being in Kawhi's hands. But if I'm the Raptors, I'm so excited about how that trade worked out for them. It accomplished the number one goal, which was getting over the hump, getting into the finals. They took their shot. They've made a great case with some of the other moves, you know, whether it's trading for Marc Gasol or just being aggressive in terms of, you know, adding guys with veteran experience, you know, so that Kawhi has a team that can compete for a title. And I'm not sure what more a superstar could want or ask for. You know, if he just wants to be in a different market, if he wants to be in a different city, that's understandable. But I think Toronto's in a really good place right now.
Ben Golliver joining us. All right, Ben, what about Kevin Durant? Golden State, of course, has not lost since he went down. So is it really not that big of a deal if Durant is not playing the first two games? Or actually, is it kind of a big deal if he doesn't play in the first two games?
It's a huge deal, Jim. This is a classic case of everybody overthinking it. Oh, yeah, you know, he's going to come back and screw things up. Yeah, I'd love to have one of the guys who's probably the best player in basketball come and screw things up for my team any day. He's welcome to do that 24/7, 365. I think from a matchup standpoint, he's just so huge in this series because he would help cancel out a Kawhi Leonard. He would be able to offset a guy like Pascal Siakam, who's been a really nice player for the Toronto Raptors, and he would just make it so much more difficult because their talent level just grows so much with him on the court. There's so many more weapons, and he's just a steady presence. And I think what we've seen from Toronto is they've done a good job this postseason of kind of controlling pace, of being in charge of the game, and then being ready to, you know, launch second-half comebacks if need be. And I think, you know, a guy like Kevin Durant, he helps you in so many ways because if your offense is, you know, struggling or hitting a rough patch, you just give the ball to him and give him a bucket. He just smooths out your entire game so you're not having those huge highs and huge lows. Like Golden State even saw in the Western Conference Finals, there was multiple games where they got down by 15 points. And I think it'd be harder to come back, from a 15-point deficit against Toronto than it was against Portland. So to me, they would love to have him back. I think as soon as he's medically cleared, he's going to play. I don't think any of this other talk about, oh, is it going to screw anything up? To me, that's just, empty noise. And I really hope he gets back on the court here because he was so sensational playing in that first round against the LA Clippers and in the opening parts of the series against the Houston Rockets. It was such a shame for him to go down with that leg injury. And I'd love for him to be able to kind of, tie a bow on his postseason and get back out there on the court.
So, Ben, ultimately, what do you think this series is going to come down to?
I think, two factors. Like I said, Kawhi Leonard, can't he be the best player on the court? Or does Steph Curry wind up taking that title, especially early on in the series before Kevin comes back? And then the second factor would be, when does Kevin come back and how does he look once he's back? I mean, to me, it comes down to the stars in this series. It usually does in the finals. I think, all the talk that's been around Kawhi Leonard and his play, it might actually, wind up overlooking the stuff that Steph's done here. The last couple of weeks without Kevin Durant, it's been 30-plus points every night, and he represents such a different challenge for Toronto because against Milwaukee, the Bucks' offense was entirely inside out, right? It's Giannis running to the hoop and then kicking out to his shooters. With Golden State's offense, though, it's completely outside in. It's Curry making you chase him all over the court. It's starting the possessions near midcourt, with their high screen and roll. It's him just needing a little bit of a sliver of daylight before he pulls up and hits three-pointers. And so that's going to be a real challenge for Toronto's defense, and I think that's going to be fascinating to watch play out. To me, this is just a star battle, Jim, and that's why I love it. That's why I'm excited for these finals. We got a little bit of new blood. There's not that Cleveland Cavaliers factor. There's not that LeBron James factor, that rivalry talk. I kind of drive this series for the last 4 years, but we still have an awful lot of star power that's going to be doing battle. And I think, one thing that we could see coming out of this series, we could be crowning a new best player in basketball, right? If the Raptors win, I think a lot of people are going to say, hey, Kawhi, you're the guy. If the Warriors win and Steph gets finals MVP, I could see people saying that for him too. And if Kevin Durant comes back into the middle of this series and changes the series, I could see people making the same argument for Kevin Durant too. So I think those are pretty good stakes and a nice table setter here as we get ready for game one tonight.
And great storylines. Storylines for days. He is a national NBA writer for the Washington Post, co-host of Open Floor Podcast. Good friend of the program, jungle legend, Ben Golliver. Ben, great job. Have fun with it. And I know we'll run you down again pretty soon.
Sounds great, Jim. Take care, man.
Game two, the Stanley Cup final last night in Boston. And as you know, if you're paying attention, the Bruins came in with all the mo in the world. It's all right, Adam, you can do your thing. Bring it on in. Since Chael moved up to other things, Adam Hawk has stepped his game up immeasurably and is multitasking. Just do your thing. Kevin in the D tweets, dear Rich, thanks for filling in on the seventh day. Signed, God. See, that was worth me interrupting my thought. Flores is getting tweets from God now. So game two of the final was last night. And as I mentioned, the Bruins came in with all the momentum in the world. They had won a ridiculous 8 straight playoff games. They were pretty much smashing everyone and everything in their path. They were 60 minutes away from taking a commanding 2-0 series lead. And that pretty much would have ended the Stanley Cup final before it even started. So they pulled out all the big guns last night knowing that. They had Bill Belichick waving the flag before the game. They had Bob Kraft waving a towel during the game. And if that old man shows up in your house with a towel, you know there's going to be a happy ending. Oh, hey, ho! Yeah, went there. You don't bring that old man into your house with a towel. Or maybe you do. Look, if you're the St. Louis Blues, how do you stand up to that? Well, I know what you don't want to do if you're looking to stand up to that. You sure as hell don't want to do this.
Pastrnak cuts to his left, leaves it for DeBrusk. DeBrusk in front, Coyle shoots, he scores! Charlie Coyle on the power play. Bruins lead 1-0.
So if the last thing you want to do if you're St. Louis is fall behind Boston 2-0, the last thing you want to do is come out and give up an early goal, and that's what they did do, less than 5 minutes in. Then St. Louis bounces right back to tie it up, but then 40 seconds later, Boston comes back and does this.
Dish it over to the far side. Back of it at the Bruins retrieve. Centered out in front. Backhand, they score! The Blues turn it over. The forecheck goes to work. And how about the poise out in front from Joakim Nordstrom?
Yeah, that's a package blast right there. You make a mistake in your own end. You start off by going down 1-0 on the road. You tie it up. You don't even get to enjoy that for a minute before you make that mistake and turn it over. And now you're down 2-1. But that's how good the Bruins are. That's how much pressure the Bruins put you under. Jordan Binnington allowed 2 goals on the first 8 shots that he faced. That's not how you want to start a game at all. Do that against that team on the road when you're already down a game, and you may as well just find a nice soft spot to lay down in and die. Except, that's not how the Blues roll. I've said it before, I'll say it again right now. These guys are tough as hell. They're brass. They do not back down. And as hard as that Torrey Krug hit was in game one, the Blues can hit you just as hard, if not harder. It's a heavy, heavy team. They tied it up before the end of the first period, and then they started to go to work on the Bruins. Boston had not lost a playoff game in nearly a month, and yet here were the Blues landing one body blow after another. Then in the third period, with 2 minutes left in a tie game, they did this.
Play will then lift it from his own end over the Boston line. Settled down. That's David Perron pulling it loose to Shin. He couldn't shoot it. They center. Gunnarsson, he scores! It gets waved off. It hit the post, I guess. I thought he scored it. I thought that went in and hit the twine. But the ref was right there, said it hit the post, and the puck control by the Bruins.
Blues radio. Now, Carl Gunnarsson, oh, he beat the goaltender. He absolutely did, but it clanked off the post. Did not find the back of the net. So you go to overtime. If you get that close to winning the game in regulation, what are you thinking when you go to overtime? Well, if you're that guy, if you're Gunnarsson, you're thinking two things. One, hit the urinal. Two, when you do, give a message to the coach. More on that in a moment. But when overtime started, the Blues absolutely dominated. Boston did not get off a shot. And just under 4 minutes into OT, with a delayed penalty, Carl Gunnarsson went legend.
Gunnarsson to O'Reilly to Gunnarsson. He scores! Boom, boom, Gunnarsson! Bring out the Zamboni! The Blues win game 2! 3-2 the final! They're coming home tied at 1!
I'm going to need some more time to finish that thought, but for the moment, let me say this. That's a hell of a goal. That's a hell of a performance. That's exactly how you do it. That's how you get your first Stanley Cup final win in team history, on the road, against a powerhouse who had been rolling. And the only thing better than the goal is the story behind that goal. We all know the excuses. I'm not going very far. I'm in such a rush. It's just too uncomfortable. Sometimes I simply forget. Look, don't kid yourself. There is no such thing as a good excuse for not buckling up. If you have used any of these excuses or any others, you're putting yourself at risk. Risk of injury, maybe even death. In 2017 alone, more than 10,000 people were unbuckled when they were killed in crashes. That's 51% of people killed in motor vehicle crashes that were not wearing seatbelts. No matter what kind of a car you drive, wearing your seatbelt is the best defense in a crash. Even when you sit in the back seat, you still have to buckle up. Same thing for when you ride in a taxi or use ride-sharing services too. Cops are on the lookout. They're writing tickets. Why would you take that risk? In 2017 alone, seatbelts saved nearly 15,000 lives. Do the smart thing. Buckle up every trip, day or night. Click it or ticket. It's paid for by NHTSA. Davante Adams is my guest. Davante, good to have you back. How are you?
Good, man. Good to be here. I appreciate you having me.
It's good to have you back, and I appreciate you doing it. All right, so you've been going through OTAs this week. Why don't we start right there? A big part of that's been working on the new offense with the new head coach, Matt LaFleur. How has that experience been so far?
It's been great, man. It's been great. It's kind of like being a rookie again for us. Obviously, we used to kind of being a little bit more comfortable in the offense that we're familiar with. So to be in a new, completely new system with a new guy leading it, he's got a totally different way of the way he leads too. So we all kind of getting to know each other and figure this thing out together. It's been real fun.
All right, so there's some good stuff in there. I know it's early, but how would you describe the offense, and how is the offense compared to ones that you've played in previous years?
It's an electrifying offense. A lot of big play potential. You see a lot of, just based off of the offenses that he's been a part of before, whether they had top tier talent or otherwise, you've seen them be able to make plays all over the field. And obviously, with the guys that we have, the quarterback we have, the running backs we have, and just all around tight ends, we got some special players. So to be in a system where now we're exposed to a lot of different things where we can get the ball in space. Not saying it's nothing that we haven't done before, but I see a lot of potential of that in these coming years.
Davante Adams joining us. You mentioned that LaFleur's leadership style is a little bit different than what you've been accustomed to. What's he like as a leader? How is it different?
It's his first year, so I can't tell if it's just a beginning thing, trying to get everybody familiar with what we got going and buying into his scheme and the way he does things, but really, really hands-on. I mean, he's at everything. He's always moving around. I see him pretty much, I feel like, 90% of the day, so he's all over the place and real energetic, and he's real open, too. It's really easy to work with him when he's open and hearing what the vets have to say, even the young guys, that he lets everybody chime in and let them know what they're comfortable with. And I feel like that's the best thing the best thing for offense is being able to be open and communicate, let each other know how we feel about any given thing. So, we just got to continue that.
Green Bay Packers wide receiver Davante Adams joining us. You mentioned the young guys. Now, you've got a number of young, talented receivers around you, and both you and the coaches are looking for you to lead them. How much do you enjoy that role, and how do you go about approaching it?
I love it. I love it. I think it's great. Obviously, over the past few years, my leadership role has expanded a lot more. So it's something that I've kind of prepped for in these past few years. So, I love any chance. Even when I was a rookie, having guys like Jordy and Randall in front of me, they always invited me to be a leader and, speak up and share different things. Because obviously, each of us have a different specific skill set that the other may not have. So it's always something that we can do to make each other better. And like I said, having those veterans in front of me, it taught me the way to be able to come and teach these young guys how to do it now.
Davante, LaFleur had a great quote about you. He said this, quote, "He sets the tone for the group, and his energy spills over to everybody on the offensive side of the ball. He's got a mentality to him, and I love it. He's a dog. He's a fighter. He elevates the play of everybody around him," end quote. Like, where does that come from? Were you always like that? Did you work your way into that? That dog mentality, where did that come from?
No, that's just something that comes from within. I feel like you can, there's a lot of things you can force in life, but I feel like that dog is one of those things that you can't really force. You can fake it and make it look a certain way, but at some point, people can kind of tell it's a facade. So, for him to speak on that, it means a lot to me, but I think it says something that, the fact that I take my job very seriously and, I'm real passionate about what I do. So anytime I go out there and I don't do anything exactly or do something exactly how I wanted it to look, I'm going to feel a certain way about that, and I'm a perfectionist. So anytime it doesn't pan out exactly how I want it, you can tell, not necessarily in a negative way, but, you know, I'm always going to go back and I ask questions and I want to know everything about what's going on. So, you know, he sees my passion on the field, whether it's talking some smack to the DBs in practice and messing around just to create a little competitive nature, or if it's in the games or whatever he's seen on film. So, yeah, that's just my job and that's just the way that I've been for, my whole life. So I just kind of pull that from within.
Green Bay wide receiver Davante Adams joining us. Now, a while back you said that you attack every offseason viciously. That was the quote, viciously. I love the description. What is your approach when it comes to the offseason, and what does that look like? How did you go about attacking this past one viciously?
Well, I mean, generally what people underestimate is the rest that you need. So coming up the season, these past two seasons have been a little harder. You know, I feel like it's a good thing to have a complaining about having to go to the Pro Bowl, but going to the Pro Bowl, I don't get the rest that I need right out the beginning. So I'm still training right after the season and making sure I'm good to be able to go there, so I'm not feeling some type of way performing in front of all those guys. So after the Pro Bowl is over, usually I take a little bit of time off and just, you know, I'm still moving around and doing different things, but I'm not hitting the weights quite as hard, and I'm not you know, I'm not out there training for the combine, you know, just for Instagram videos. I take what I do seriously. I'm doing a lot of treatment at that point, making sure my body feels good after the season. You know, obviously that everybody talks about how long that season is. So, you know, I'm doing everything I can to make sure when I do hit it hard, and about maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks later of just, you know, relaxing more so that my body's ready to do it. I don't want to have anything linger from the season before. And, you know, obviously my craft and route running, I take that real serious. So I travel around. I've got a wideout coach by the name of Keith Williams, who I've been working with ever since I first went to Fresno State. So I go to Nebraska, you know, whatever it is. If I got to go to Nebraska, I got to go to New Orleans to go train with him. I'm doing whatever it is that I got to do. So, you know, I just think that it's something that young wideouts in college or in the pros need to take serious, and is their craft. Not necessarily about doing certain workouts just for the look, making sure you're doing whatever's going to benefit you on the field.
Davante Adams joining us. I mean, your approach is pretty serious, and it's pretty evident. You and I have talked in the past that when you were coming up, you may have been a little under the radar, but now you're a two-time Pro Bowler. You're putting up huge numbers. You're a leader on a premium franchise. Does it feel to you like everybody now understands how good you are, or do you still approach it like you're a little bit under the radar?
No, I definitely approach it like I'm under the radar. I feel like there's, you know, people have their moments when they bring it up, and it kind of just depends. I feel like with me, it's more so whatever I did that week. They, you know, they say that I'm one of the best receivers in the league or the best receiver or whatever. And then, you know, if you have a down week, but it needs to be to the point where everybody just understands. So all I can do is just continue to work. And I mean, like I said, it's just proven. The proof is in the pudding. So, you know, stack years of doing what I've been doing these past few years, and just be consistent, man, and that's all it's going to take.
Got a great quarterback, obviously, in Aaron Rodgers, slinging it around. Is there something maybe you know about him now that you didn't know about him when you first got into the NFL?
I mean, there's a lot of things. It's tough to pinpoint one, but, yeah, I mean, that's a tough question, honestly. I think that there's things that maybe I learned a little bit more as we went along, but, I mean, he's a closed book as far as, you know, the details of his life and things like that you continue to learn as you build that bond with him and things like that. But on the field, I try to learn him as much as I could. I talked to him on my draft day, so I wanted to figure out this guy who, you know, this potential, or not potential, proven Hall of Famer. I wanted to figure out as much as I can out the gate. So, you know, there wasn't any surprises, and we could get on the same page as quick as possible. So he's been always real open and receptive to me. So I feel like, you know, there's things that you continue to learn about a person as you get to know him a little bit better. But for the most part, he put a lot out there for me.
Davante Adams joining us for a few more moments. You mentioned Instagram. Did I see on Instagram that you hit up the Kentucky Derby? How did that go?
Yeah, that was good. That was another thing that I did with 12. He invited me the past couple of years, but I had a deal with Pepsi that I've had to do that same weekend for the past few years, so I wasn't able to go. But this year we were able to make it happen. It was a good experience, man. Didn't win a single bet the whole time, so not one race did I do win any money on. I didn't lose too much because I just kind of stuck my toes in there. I wasn't really comfortable with blowing a bunch of money out there when I didn't exactly know how to bet yet. But, I mean, it was a good experience. It was just fun being out there with those guys. Aaron's the type of guy, he likes to be there for the first race and through the last, so it was a long day. But other than that, we had a real good time.
It is a long day. It's a long day at the track. When you have like 30 minutes between races and you get there for the first and you stay for the last,
exactly.
That would be a really long day. Listen, before you go, a few months back.
Yeah, I didn't know all that either.
I didn't know
that it was that. I thought it was back to back to back. I didn't know that they take that much time in between, and it kind of threw me off a little bit.
No, it does. It does. And the races are so short. You got to pace yourself. That's a long, long day. So if you come out too quickly and you drink too much too quickly and you start losing money, it could really go sideways on you. It sounds to me like you handled that really well. So a few months back, there was talk about whether or not Kansas City would allow Patrick Mahomes to play basketball in the offseason. What was your reaction when you saw that?
I mean, you understand, I guess. You got to understand their side of it. That's their franchise player. I'm sure if it was that, the practice squad left tackle, they wouldn't be worried about it quite as much. But being who he is, you got to understand. But, I mean, you got to let guys do what they do in off season. I mean, they take motorcycles and stuff like that away from us. But to be able to, I mean, it's good cardio. And I love playing basketball. So it's another thing. That's another thing me and Matt have talked about, too. He's not a big fan of guys playing basketball in off season. But he knows that's my first love right there. I didn't play football until my junior year in high school. So I was always basketball. So earlier in my career, any chance I got, I was out there playing some pickup, messing around, and being safe, obviously. But I use that as a good source of cardio. I feel like if you're in good basketball shape, you're going to be in great football shape. So, I definitely understand where they're coming from, but you got to let the guy live, especially when you got moves like that, because I didn't know Pat could play basketball the way he could.
He's got some athletic skills, doesn't he? Devontae, really quickly, I got about a minute. Thursday means we're 2 days off from the Green and Gold charity softball game Saturday. How much are you looking forward to that?
Man, I'm looking forward to it a lot. Every year I've been, and it's been a lot of fun, man. Obviously, since it's been dating back about 20 years now, I think Donald Driver hosted it before, then Jordy, then now myself. And last year, Clay helped me out with it. This year, Blake Martinez. It's a great way to give back, and hoping to see a lot of fans out there. We get a chance to interact, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Dude, you have had an amazing run. I mean, not only are you one of the leaders among the young receivers, you are now a leader of the Green Bay Packers. You are a preeminent player and a leader of a great franchise. Really nice to have you back on the show. Appreciate the conversation. Let's make sure we do it again soon.
Thank you, man. I appreciate you.
Bit of a Woj bomb. Woj reported that Rockets GM Daryl Morey has made his entire roster and future draft picks available in trade talks. Right. Because, of course, he has. He's Daryl Morey. Look, a lot of you don't like this guy. A lot of you really don't like this guy. I love the guy. I love the guy, and I love his style, and this is why. Remember when KD joined the Warriors, and everybody was so pissed, and nobody wanted any part of trying to run up on them. Nobody wanted any part of challenging that conglomerate. Nobody wanted anything to do with Golden State except Daryl. He anteed the hell up. He wanted a piece of that. He wanted to slay that dragon. So while everybody else was looking to rebuild or regroup or waiting for Golden State to age out, Morey and the Rockets accepted the challenge. Like, the most competitive people in the world work in professional sports. And I'm here to tell you, I don't think anybody anywhere wants to win as badly as Daryl Morey does. I'm really impressed by it. Really impressed. Because giving Golden State hell was not enough. Just getting there was not enough. They gave them hell last year. They pushed them to 7 games, remember? Last year. As you also will remember, the rap was, we were better. The Rockets. The Rockets were better. We should have won. We would have won. If Chris Paul didn't get hurt. We would have won if Chris Paul didn't get hurt. Right. And again, if my aunt had nads, she'd be my uncle. We would have won if Chris Paul didn't get hurt. Right. Well, you had Chris Paul this year. He didn't get hurt. The Warriors didn't have Kevin Durant. He did get hurt. And the Rockets still didn't get it done. Which is why Daryl Morey is looking to take a wrecking ball to it again. And he should. Because he shot his shot and missed. It didn't work. So now what do you do? This is why this guy's pay grade is much higher than mine. This guy's way smarter than I'll ever be. But what do you do now? I mean, the question is, great, everybody's available, but what can you get for who you have? Oh, you can trade Chris Paul. Oh, all right. So what can you get for Chris Paul? who is now 34, on the decline, getting older, not better, and his numbers across the board are getting worse. His numbers across the board are getting worse, but no number is worse than paying an old 6-foot point guard $124 million over the next 3 years. That's not a positive number on Daryl's analytics spreadsheet any longer. Now, did he sign him to that contract? He did, but he knows that it no longer works, and he's ready to move on. And as far as Paul, you know, as good a player as he is, and he's a great player, no longer like super, super elite, but still a great player, still an effective player, still a Hall of Famer, but as great as he is, not the easiest guy to be around or to run with, according to that Woj report. The Harden Paul dynamic was, quote, not without challenges this season. And does that surprise anybody? Beard's not going anywhere. But you have to think that Paul will. And it would not surprise me, if you ask me where's Chris Paul going to end up, it would not surprise me that at the end of the day, the guy were to end up here in L.A. with the Lakers as a consolation prize after the Lakers whiff again on every other free agent that matters. Once they find out that KD, Kyrie, even Klay want nothing to do with them, they'll end up with that consolation prize. I mean, no free agent worth a damn who has options is coming anywhere near that Laker clown show right now. So they'll end up doing what they've done in recent years. When they can't convince anybody who matters to come in, they'll overpay somebody past his prime, who LeBron likes. And who better describes that or fits that than Chris Paul? Past their prime as a consolation because the guys they wanted wouldn't take their money that LeBron likes. It's got Chris Paul written all over it. Fellow banana boater, Chris Paul, written all over it. As for the Rockets, that may have been their best shot to get it done, and they failed. Which is why Morey's going to drop a bomb on that thing again. You can't knock that dude's hustle. Nobody wants it worse. Nobody's willing to take a bigger swing. And I can't wait to see what that guy has up his sleeve this time. But what I can wait to see is old man Paul running alongside old man LeBron. And how long before old man Dwanye and that ball Jack Mello join the party? Wait till they get that band back together. Love Daryl Morey. I love the idea of him blowing up his team again. That's what the guy does. That's who he is. I love it. I love that about that guy. It's like the ultimate puzzle. I love to see that guy break that thing down and put it back together again every couple of years. Dude definitely is playing chess. It's fun to watch. Tony Luffman joins us once again. Tony, what's going on? How are you?
Rome, I am thrilled to be with you. And let me tell you, one of the best tweets I saw about last night's game, which really summed it up, was by the great Jim Rome, who wrote, "Blues are brass as hell." 11:13 p.m. Well said, my man. Well said.
My man, Tony Luffman. Thank you very much for saying so. All right, Tony, I want to get into that. But before I get into that, this time last year, when you were in Vegas for Capitals Golden Knights, we talked about the Taco Bell Cantina right there on Las Vegas Boulevard. The first two games were in Boston. You're always going to be somebody who takes the pulse of the town when you're in a city. What was the vibe like in Boston? What kind of feeling were you getting as you walked the streets, went to restaurants, and talked to waiters?
I'm so glad you asked this question. I go out to eat with our crew. We got a lot of really talented people, and we're eating at this awesome Italian restaurant. And our server says with a straight face, Rome, boy, the Celtics really let us down. This is going to be a long time for us to wait between parades. And I said, how dare you?
Right.
The St. Louis Blues have waited 49 years to get back to the Cup Final. You guys win at everything. And there he was, the hoodie, to use a Romeism, to Rome. The hoodie's waving the flag last night. 6 rings. That place is unbelievable. You know, we both grew up in Southern California. We were so excited as kids with the L.A. Raiders and the Lakers. What Boston has done is incredible by comparison. Truly the city of champions.
Tony Loveman joining us. All right, so everybody knew the St. Louis Blues were tough, but then they get up 2-0 in game one. Boston rallies. They come back to win 4-2. It's one thing to be tough. It's another to run into a team that has been steamrolling everybody the way Boston has. Going into last night's game, what kind of a response were you expecting from St. Louis?
I thought they were going to play a heavier game because that's who they are. That's their identity. But your point is well taken. They were steamrolled in game one. After that first period where they're able to control the play and they're up 2-0, over the course of the next 25 or so game minutes, they were able to manage 3 shots on goal while Boston scored 3 goals. And frankly, even talking with Blues people, they acknowledge that Boston is more talented. But one of the things we all love about hockey, the ultimate team sport, if you play hard enough, and boy, does Craig Berube have this team playing hard, it doesn't matter if you're not the most talented team. Listen, the team they played in the first round, Winnipeg, they went to the Western Conference Final last year. I think Winnipeg's more talented, and the Blues people think that Winnipeg's more talented. It doesn't matter. The way this team plays, they're in every game, and they're getting great goaltending from Jordan Binnington.
Tony Loveman joining us. All right, so Carl Gunnarsson hits that post with 2 minutes to go in the third period. And then according to legend, he's standing next to his coach at the urinal before overtime. Tony says, I just need one more. He got that one more less than 4 minutes into OT. How huge was that moment?
Huge, and especially considering it's an unlikely source. Carl Gunnarsson, not the most prolific defensive scorer on this club, but that's the beauty of the Stanley Cup playoffs and specifically the Cup Finals. I sit next to Mike Rupp every single night we're covering this hockey final, and I think back to him being a reserve for the New Jersey Devils and scoring the cup-clinching goal. It takes the whole team. And Craig Berube, we laugh about the two of them meeting in what Berube calls, quote-unquote, the pisser.
Right.
That's who he is. He is one of these guys that he seems so accessible that I don't know that he gets enough credit for being a very bright hockey mind, and he's so intimidating. We think back to him and all the penalty minutes and all the fights. He deserves a ton of credit. And if you talk to the Blues players enough, they'll all tell you that. Ryan O'Reilly used the word monumental to describe the impact he had on this team going from worst in the league at 31st place on January 3rd to where they are now.
In fact, on that point, Berube, and also you mentioned Mike Rupp, you and Rupp were talking before the game about the adjustments that the Blues needed to make and how he wanted to see the Blues take what the Bruins were giving them instead of just trying to force the matter and have that lead to turnovers. What did you make of the adjustments that St. Louis did make?
They did that. They did exactly that. And it's a simple adjustment, but it's difficult to do because the Bees play with so much pace. They are such a fast team. But the Blues clearly have enough pace to compete and to be dangerous. It comes down to the rink shrinking. It's a Kevin Weeks line that I use again and again over the course of the playoffs. There's just not a lot of space out there. In fact, Braden Schenn had 8 hits last night, and he said after the game, it's the most physical game he's ever played in. It's what you'd expect. They're playing for permanence. This is immortality. You're playing for Lord Stanley's Cup. But it is a violent, physical game out there, and it is incredible to watch as a fan. Even casual fans that watched last night's game had to fall in love with the game.
Tony Loveman joining us. All right, you mentioned Blues goalie Jordan Binnington. Now, he gave up 2 goals on the first 8 shots that he faced, but then he really cleaned things up, especially in the way he was handling rebounds. What do you make of the way he played last night and how he's played throughout the entire run?
He is swag personified. He had the best soundbite of the entire season. Very early on when they were turning this thing around, he said, when he was asked about looking calm and kind of always having that in-control demeanor, he said, do I look nervous? There's your answer. It was like Clint Eastwood. It was so impressive that a young kid would have this much poise, composure, confidence. And it's not a coincidence that after losses, he bounces back strong. 12-2 now in that scenario. Once it happens that many times, and when you're around him, there just is an air of confidence, a total belief in his ability. This is a guy that was overlooked. He comes from off the periphery, and you and I both love sports history. Coming into St. Louis, I was thinking about Kurt Warner and the 99 Rams. Similar story, kind of out of the shadows. Trent Green goes down 20 years ago exactly. It's the 99 Rams, and this is Binnington's story too. Really likable guy. Very easy to root for, just like Kurt Warner.
And amazing. A rookie showing up the way he is on the biggest stage. We talked about what it's like in Boston, the vibe in Boston. The Blues have not been to the final in 49 years. They just got their first win in the final. They're coming back home to St. Louis with a chance to take a series lead. What kind of an atmosphere are you expecting in St. Louis?
Insane, Rome. I brought a Band-Aid to wear on my face to pay tribute to Nelly, the great Nelly. From the Lou. I don't know if anybody else is going to do that, but that's the level of respect I have for this place. And I appreciate the fact that my Uber driver, I land today, the Uber driver is just rattling off all these facts about the Blues. And he finally, when we arrive at the hotel, he gets out to help me with my bag. He's wearing a St. Louis Blues shirt. It's the Blues logo, the blue note. And in the note is the word, the name, Gloria. This whole place, everywhere you go, they're playing that song, their celebratory song. The whole city. It reminds me of the movie Major League, which is a movie, but that's really what it's like here. Everything is swept up in Cup Final fever because, as you pointed out, 49 years is a long time between trips to the Stanley Cup Final.
Alvy's been bumping Gloria during the show today as well. All right, nice. So what? Tony, what about the Bruins? How do you think the Bruins respond to losing Game 2? How do you expect the Bruins to show up in Game 3?
I think they come back strong. I'll tell you, the biggest concern for me is Matt Grizzlick. The hit he took, he's one of the easiest guys to root for. His dad works on what's called the Bull Gang, the conversion crew. When an arena has a concert, and then they have a basketball game, and then they have an ice hockey game, one of the longstanding members of that crew is Matt Grizzlick's father. His name's John. We've all been interacting with him and his son over the last few days. The hit he took from Oscar Sundquist got Sundquist a meeting with the Department of Player Safety. So a suspension is looming. The Bees are going to miss him. There's no doubt about it. But I think they come back strong. They are the better team, as we established earlier. I wonder just how long St. Louis can continue to hang around. I love the emotion. I love the story. But my mind tells me the better team will win in this series, and I feel like Boston is the better team.
Tony Loughman, NHL Network host, my guest. Tony, one more thought, and I'm going to go back to Boston. Now, you're somebody who's always positive, somebody who's always energetic, upbeat, always bringing it, somebody who likes pop culture. How amped were you to talk to Bobby Farrelly, director of Dumb and Dumber, about Cam Neely's performance as Seabass?
I was beside myself. There are those days, you know, we both have these great thrills doing what we do, doing what we love. That was an interview that I spent zero time preparing for on the day because I'd spent basically decades preparing for it, whether it's me, myself, and Irene. The look on his face, Rome, when he first sat down and I was doing the Jim Carrey, when he was doing that dance where he would become the evil guy and say, "What's up, Buttercup?" He was looking at me like, "What's wrong with you?" But seriously, I could not maintain a sense of calm. And then the me, myself, and Irene discussion we had off the air spills onto the air when we're talking about Dumb and Dumber. That guy's an amazing creative mind. It was so cool to talk with him, and he really loved the Bees. He played goalie back in the day, and so he and Kevin Weeks were knocking it around as members of the goalie union. It was really cool to listen to.
You can watch Tony Loughman, and he's reporting on the Blues and Bruins throughout the series on NHL Network. Remember, after the Cup Final, he will return to co-hosting Change Up, DAZN's new MLB whip-around show. He is an NHL Network host. He is a friend of the program. He is a clone. He's all about Gloria. Tony Loughman, my guest. Tony, great job, man. Great to have you back. Thank you so much. Have a great series.
Likewise. Great visiting with you. Thanks, Rome.
Miles in Greece. Miles, bro, are you really calling from Greece?
Rome, I am literally standing in Santorini looking at the caldera, looking at this beautiful sunset because it's like 10 hours, you know, ahead of where y'all are or whatever. And I want to take a minute to just thank Rich Flores for, you know, making this volcano erupt 2,500 years ago and allowing me on this wonderful view on my honeymoon. Pretty amazing.
That is amazing. All right, Miles, you better get back to your honeymoon. I don't think the...
Hey, Rome. Yeah, yeah. Wore my wife for letting me do this on my honeymoon, buddy. But listen, have a great rest of the show.
Dude, do me a favor. Tweet a picture of it so I know it's legit. We go to Sweden. Torval. Hey, Torval, what's up? It's probably the phone connection in Sweden, right?
Yeah. We love the Raiders here in Sweden.
You do? So yeah. are you a longtime Raider fan? What's up? Are you?
Well, all of our ancestors raided all of Europe, so we'd be following the Raiders.
Yeah, thanks, Tor. Yeah, go ahead.
Those tools next door in Norway, they like the Vikings, but that's a loser team.
Well said. Well said.
We love that.
You know what? I don't think that guy's in Sweden.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Let's see. That's a 920 area code. I don't think Sweden is the 920. Let's get a phone call in here quickly. We go to North Carolina. Buddy. Hey, buddy. How are you?
Hey, Jim. How are you, buddy?
Good, man. Good. You?
Yeah, I'm all right. You know, I was watching that game, and I saw that, you know, what happened. And I told your one of you guys when they answered the phone, you know, in 1959, I was in the fifth grade, and I was living in Rhode Island, and I was part of the safety patrol, you know, we have them little flags where you put out to help cross the kids, and we got to go to Fenway Park, and a foul ball got hit and hit this woman in her face, and it was just nothing but mass blood. And ever since then, that was 1959, ever since then, I've wondered why we do not follow what the Japanese do in all these fields. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me. It really doesn't.
No, buddy, I agree with you. I think I can answer the question. Thank you very much. I appreciate you, buddy. Benny, what's going on?
Hey, not much. Thank you for the profile. I cannot believe that I jumped in front of our boy Rich Flores in the profile batting order, but I'll take it. Now, not to take up too much time here, but all this geriatric talk has reminded me of an old Swisco family story that's been passed from generation to generation. Now, say, back in 1824 or any given year in the past, my great-great-great-grandpappy Wisco was on his way back to the family camp after picking up some flour, sugar, whiskey, some other old-timey staples from the nearest trading post, and he came across a man and a horse. Now, this horse wasn't animated. It was just laying there, and this man was just punching this thing over and over again. I mean, just throttling the thing. And great-great-grandpappy Wisco was like, dude, who are you and what the hell are you doing? And the man turned around and said, my name is Rich Flores, and I am beating a dead horse. Now, I fully realize that I'm kind of beating a dead horse with another historically-based Rich Flores joke, but if it weren't for Rich Flores, we wouldn't be able to use the term beating a dead horse. So thanks, Richie. Good luck on the 21st. Rome, thanks for the profile. We'll be in touch real soon. Keep it weird, man.
Good night now!